No.
Okay. Just a few sort of closing words, the last little Dharma talk. Because some of you will not realize just how calm and peaceful you've become over the last 9 days. Simply because that we've been meditating together, we've been walking together, eating together. And because of that, that we all get slower and more calmer. It's only afterwards when you go outside you realize just how slowed down you've become. Because I remember from my first retreats, when I left the retreat place, I couldn't believe just how frantically everybody ran around outside the walls of that retreat center. I couldn't believe just how fast and how loudly they spoke. And I couldn't believe just sometimes the lack of calm, the lack of compassion in their voice, simply because of the rush to go wherever they were going. So because of that, I'm going to ask you that when you leave here, to go very slowly at first. If you are driving a car back home, even just another place at Yucca, just go a few laps around the car park or down this little alleyway first of all. Because when you get out on that road, it's the crazy people out there, people who haven't been on a retreat. And sometimes your reflexes are just so soft that when a car comes up, you just say, let go, let go, let go, crash. I don't want to send you to Nirvana too soon. So be very careful when you leave this retreat. But also just to be mindful and just to see just how much you actually have changed. Everyone who's been on this retreat, even the ones who think, oh, my meditation wasn't so good. Oh, it wasn't really so peaceful. I did a lot of sleeping, a lot of eating, but you'd be amazed at how good your meditation has been when you go outside. You have cooled down, you've slowed down. And it's amazing when you go outside just how much more you see, how much more you know, and how much calmer you are amongst all of your friends and relations. So it will show you just the power of a retreat like this. It actually does something quite significantly to you. Not only that, your friends and relatives, they will notice that change in you, as I was saying last night. They do realize that a person who's done 9 days of retreat, who's lived a pure life of keeping precepts, not harming anybody, always telling the truth, you live such a pure lifestyle that does have an effect on your heart. You actually do become beautiful people in the best sense of the word. And when other people see you, oh, they just love you so much. There's a person who's calm and peaceful and compassionate in our world. So in the office, people will be coming around you and say, what have you been doing the last 9 days? You look so refreshed. You look so relaxed. You look so peaceful and so calm. And then you can tell them, I've been to Club Med. Say, Club Med, I never realized there was a Club Med in Ipoh. Yes, there is. Club Med, Itation. And what that will do, that's one of the best ways of actually spreading the Dharma around or spreading loving kindness. Because you're giving them the gift of inspiration, of peace, of truth. If each one of you are not quite sure why you came to this retreat or why you came to listen to Dharma in the first place, but usually it's the case you saw someone which inspired you. You saw the peace or the happiness in their heart or in their expression or in the way they did things. You thought, my goodness, that's beautiful, that's wonderful, I want something like that. And that's been the experience which I've had as a monk over many years. That many people have written out to me afterwards. They said, when I first came to meditation, I thought it was just something for the body, just to get rid of my cancer or to get rid of my stress. When I saw that you monks, you seem to be so peaceful and so happy, so kind and compassionate, that whatever you had, I wanted some of. And this is always the best way to spread goodness and kindness in the world. By example, I read a story some months ago, and the story was about this man who owned a small shop in New York, a delicatessen. And one evening, he was closing up quite late, a thief, a robber, came into his deli, pulled out a gun, pointed it at the deli owner and asked for all of the contents of the cash box, all of the day's receipts. He was only a poor little owner of a shop, but nevertheless he smiled, and he gladly gave all the money he had earned that day to this thief. But after he gave the money to the thief, he said, "Excuse me, sir, when was the last time you've eaten?" And the thief was quite taken aback by that kindness, especially when you have your gun pointed to you and someone's robbing you. He said, "Actually, just only this morning, I had some breakfast, haven't eaten since." And so Deliona said, "Please wait for a few moments. Here, have these sandwiches, have a pie, and have a Coca-Cola to wash it down. Here, have it from me." And the thief was just taken aback at the kindness of somebody who, when he was being robbed, only thought of the other person. And the thief ran out. But the next day he came back again, and the thief gave all the money back and said, "When I came in here, I stole the wrong thing. What I really wanted, and what I want to steal from you now, is your wisdom and happiness and compassion." He pulled out his gun. "Now please teach me compassion." There's an interesting story there about the thief. He first of all, he thought that money was what he really wanted. But what most people want in life is that beautiful peace, that compassion, that kindness, which is always there, caring for others and looking after them. I've been telling my monks recently, and not just my monks, just many supporters and devotees, about a story from the Christian tradition, because I don't care where you get truth, honesty, beauty, wisdom. Wherever you get that, I like to make use of it and celebrate it. That many of you, if you were brought up in Christian schools, you'll know that one of the great persons of the Christian tradition was St. Francis of Assisi. And the Franciscans were very similar to Buddhist monks. Not only did they wear brown robes, they also went on arms round. They begged for their food. And lastly, that they never had any money. They were completely penniless. And the story which I like perhaps the most was the story of one of his disciples who was also a Franciscan monk. And one day this monk went on alms round, went begging for food in the town. And he came across a very, very poor man. And this very poor man asked for something from the monk. He said, "Please give me something, I beg something from you." And the monk said, "Look, I have nothing to give you. I have no money myself, and I am begging for food." And this poor man said, "Look, I haven't eaten for days, I need something, please give me something, anything will do." And the man said, "Look, I've got nothing, all I've got is my robe." And so the poor man said, "That will do." So this monk took off his robe out of compassion and kindness and gave it to this poor beggar. And that was the only robe he had. Not like monks, my monks, Buddhist monks, who got robes underneath. That was the only thing he had. So when he got back to the monastery, he was completely naked. When he knocked on the door, they tried to shoo him away. "Get out of here, you pervert. You know, get some clothes on. I don't know what you want to hear." And he shouted out, "Don't you remember me? I'm Brother So-and-so. I'm one of the monks here." "No, you're not. Get away." "Yes, I am." And soon somebody recognized him. Yeah, it was him. So they invited him in and gave him another robe and asked, "What happened? Were you robbed? Were you assaulted?" He told the story. "No. It was just that this very, very poor man asked for something. I had more than he had. So I gave him my robe." And everybody, including the abbot, thought, "Wow, that's real generosity. That's really beautiful." The problem was with generosity that sometimes people take advantage of you. Certainly that poor man who got the monk's robe spread it all around the poor people, the beggars of the city, because the next day he went on alms round, they were waiting for him. One of the little beggars said, "Please give me something." And the monk said again, "I've got nothing except this new robe." "That will do," said the beggar. So he gave his robe away a second time. And he came back to the monastery a second time. This time they recognized him. "Come in." And they gave him a new robe. And I don't know if they got this from Buddhism, but things always tend to happen three times. He went begging a third time. Again, another beggar saw him and thought he was a soft touch, as they say. He's a bit soft in the head, he'll give you even his robe. So they said, oh, I'm so poor. And this very kind and generous monk took off his robe a third time and gave it to this poor beggar. And when he came back to the monastery this time, the monks were getting a bit fed up with him, always coming back naked. So the abbot called him to his office and gave him a scolding. It's all right to be generous, but there's only so many robes which we have in our storeroom, given by our generous supporters. You're not supposed to give these things away. They're making a fool of you. Yeah, the first person may have been poor, but these other people aren't. You shouldn't do this. Don't do it again. We can't keep giving you robes. You can't have our monks walking naked through the streets. What would everybody think? What would you think if I walked naked through the streets of Ippo because I was generous and gave robes to you? That just wouldn't do. He was scolded this poor monk for over an hour. And this poor monk, he just put his head down and took the scolding. He never argued back. And you think he had a right to argue back? He'd done nothing wrong. He'd just been kind, that's all. But he just put his head down and received all the scolding. And when the abbot thought that he taught him a lesson, and he'd never do it again, he sent the monk out. And the monk was back half an hour later, knocking at the door. Sorry, he hadn't gone out, he still had his robe on, knocking at the abbot's door. And the abbot said, what do you want? And this monk had a cup of soup, of hot soup. And the monk said, no, Lord Abbot, sir, you gave me such a scolding, you were shouting so much, I went back and felt sorry for your voice. You must have a sore throat. This is to ease your sore throat. And the point was, this monk was not trying to be funny. That was his nature. He never thought of himself. All the time he was being scolded, he just thought, how sore the throat of that poor abbot must be. And that's why he just gave him the glass of soup. Now that's really what compassion truly is. And that gives some beauty into our world, some kindness. And that beauty and kindness is what makes life worth living. It's a letting go, it's a giving, not thinking of anything for yourself. The second story is, I think I mentioned to somebody during the interview time, with a story I also read a year or two ago. And again, it's a beautiful story. This time, it wasn't really begging. It was just a poor man in the United States who was at university going to medical school. And many of you who maybe sent your children to study overseas know how expensive it can be. And even if you are born in that country, especially the United States, you still have to pay quite a lot of money. So this poor young man was supplementing his income so he could pay his fees by just doing a job of being a door-to-door salesman, which is the hardest of all jobs, just knocking on people's doors and asking if they need something, if they want something to sell. And that's the only job he could get, so there he was working day after day during his vacation trying to sell things. And he knocked on one door, and a middle-aged woman answered it. And she said, look, whatever you have to sell, I don't want anything. You can go away. And that was a usual, actually that was a polite reply when you go selling door to door. The old lady paused and said, wait a moment, young man. Because she saw that he looked quite haggard and thin. When was the last time you had something to eat? And he too said, well, I've been working all morning. I didn't have anything since breakfast time. It was a hot day, it was late in the afternoon. So she smiled and said, just wait a few moments, young man. And she went to her kitchen and got a glass of milk and a few cookies and gave it to this young student. And the young student took them with great appreciation. Even though he hadn't got a sale, he had something to drink and something to eat. And he always remembered that young man, that woman. Because he told his story many years later, that when he was a doctor, a specialist making heaps of money in one of the great New York hospitals. Because one of his patients had a very advanced and difficult cancer, most times that it was untreatable, terminal. But he decided to give this woman a chance. He gave her extra special treatment. He called in some of his friends from interstate to advise and to help. And he really gave her the works to try and heal her cancer. And it worked. He managed to turn the cancer into remission. When she got her bill in the hospital room, you know how expensive those medical bills are in the United States. She was so afraid whether she would have enough money to pay for this, or how much of a loan she'd have to get from the bank, how much property she'd have to sell to pay that very expensive medical bill. Because there's many sort of treatments and a couple of operations. When she opened the bill, she cried. Because on that bill was written, paid for 30 years ago with one glass of milk and a few cookies. He remembered her. When she saw that patient's name and the address, he remembered that that was a girl many, many years ago whose door he knocked upon as a young medical student, who saw him and saw how hungry and thirsty he was and just gave him some cookies and a glass of milk. He never forgot her, nor where she lived. And when he saw the patient's name on his list and saw the address, that's why he gave her such amazing, wonderful attention. Healed her. And when he wrote out the bill, doesn't matter how many hundreds of thousands it would have been, paid for with a glass of milk and a few cookies. So these are beautiful stories of the kindness, true stories, the kindness and the generosity, the compassion, which makes life worth living, which even when we think about it, takes us up to a heavenly feeling of beauty and freedom. I like to tell such stories at the end of the retreat, because it shows you what life is all about and what meditation is all about. Meditation should never be hard and painful. It's not sort of striving to push over obstacles and destroy things. The meditation should never be faced like a US Marine, just going in there with all guns blazing, trying to shoot down every department and thinking that your mental strength is enough, your willpower, your force is enough to create these beautiful things like compassion, peace and freedom. When you have a taste of what peace, compassion, freedom truly are, you realize that it will never work. We never use force. We never use war. We never use violence in meditation. In fact, we use these beautiful, subtle things which are far more powerful than violence and war and aggression. This beautiful tenderness of wisdom, which can see a problem, and just through stories like the glass of milk and a few cookies, can give you a sense of freedom, beauty, inspiration, which can at one stroke just lessen the hardness, the pain, the difficulties of life, which can make you look in a different way, see with a different perspective. And from that perspective, all those things which you thought were so troublesome, so painful, so difficult in life, all tend to completely disappear. This is what we mean by insight, opening the door of the heart to actually to feel the truth, to feel the beauty, to know what real Buddhism, religion, truth, liberation is. Not as a theory, but as something you feel in your heart. Which is why I run the retreats in this way. I have tried other ways to run retreats, tried to make them very stiff, where everybody has to come to the meetings at a certain time, and when it's lights out, everybody has to go back no matter what. But I don't know, there's something about them which, inside of me, I don't think is very Buddhist. It's too regimented, too like an army camp, rather than a beautiful meditation camp, which understands the differences of every being in this place. When it's so regimented, people have so much fear. And as I listened to you when you were saying about coming to your first retreat, many of you came with fear to this retreat, and you go away with confidence instead. So saying, yeah, you can do this, it's not that hard, in fact it's beautiful, and you'll tell all your friends. They'd never be afraid of a meditation retreat. It's just one of the most wonderful, peaceful, easiest, encouraging, inspiring things you've ever done in your life. And it really doesn't matter just whether you've achieved this or achieved that in this retreat. What's most important, we get across the message of actually what works. The kindness, the peace, the ease. Where you encourage yourself, but you never force yourself. And where you see me say that it doesn't matter how much you slept, I always support that. And I never criticize or find fault in any which way. In all those interviews which have come, I've never scolded one of you. I've never shouted at anybody. But always with encouragement. I try and teach by example, by the softness, by the encouragement. If I don't shout at you, then maybe you won't shout at yourself. And in the quietness of your still period, you won't go along and say, oh, I'm stupid, why did I do this? I had this wonderful retreat, I slept so much, I talked so much, I didn't meditate enough, oh, what a waste of time, I'm hopeless, I'm terrible. Never scold yourself. And if you find somebody else scolding you, just go and get them a cup of soup or something. And not to pour on their head, mind you, just so they don't get such a sore throat. It's always thinking about others, not so much thinking about yourself. And as such, we find the essence of meditation. Perhaps that's what I really wanted to focus on in this last talk, the essence of meditation. Not so much what you achieve, but how you do it and what worked in this meditation retreat. That stillness, that peacefulness, that gentleness, that letting go, that contentment, that this is good enough. That incredible compassion, which like a mother loves her only child. You love this only moment which you're experiencing now. You care for it, you caress it, you nurture it. But you're never violent towards this moment, no matter what it is. And with that caring, with that nurturing, with that accepting, whoever you are, you may be somebody suffering from chronic depression, you may have so much pain, you may have cancers, you may have all these different, what people call problems, but you say, this is good enough for me. I'm so happy to be who I am, where I am, how I am. You can say that to yourself in every moment. You know the essence of meditation and how that leads to the deepest and most wonderful states. If the goal of meditation is something so pure and wonderful and transcendent as Nirvana, surely the vehicle, the way, the road by which we reach Nirvana also has to be pure and kind and subtle and wonderful. So you'll always know the destination by the road which gets there. And so if you have some idea of what Nirvana is, the peace, the beauty, the inspiration, the acceptance, you'll understand what you have to do to get there. Be peaceful. Be content. Free from all comparison and all judging. Be free from all wanting to be something different than this moment is. Be free, be content, let go. And there's a few moments each one of you have had in this retreat when you have done that. And when you do this, there's a sense of seeing the Dhamma. Seeing the Dhamma doesn't mean like Anicca Dukkha Anatta, it doesn't mean like Four Noble Truths. It's seeing that peace in your heart, that freedom, that ease. That's what I mean by seeing the Dhamma. Because the Buddha once said, the one who sees the Dhamma has a taste of freedom. That's such a beautiful word. It was the title of one of Ajahn Chah's books. A taste of freedom. Now on a meditation retreat like this, that's my goal. To give you all a taste of freedom. Even if it's only a small taste, a few moments. When you're sitting there and you feel so peaceful, so light, you don't want to be anywhere else in the whole world. Feel so good, so much energy, so much joy, so much ease. What we call freedom. And I think each one of you, in lesser or greater degrees, for longer or shorter periods of time, has had that taste of freedom. And it's beautiful to actually to feel that, to know that. But this is what nirvana is. This is how you feel that freedom. This is what it is. The taste of freedom. And when you have that taste, it's something you'll never forget. It's something which will be with you for the rest of your life. It's that taste of freedom which will bring you to the next retreat, or which will make you meditate at home. You have no choice, as I say, once you taste freedom. It's such a beautiful, delicious taste. It's the most purest thing in the whole of existence. Just like the Buddha would taste it and show it to others, so other people would follow after that taste of freedom, and they would experience it for longer and longer. After you've had the taste of freedom, the next comes the meal of freedom, and then the satisfaction for having eaten the Dhamma and become Nirvana. So this is actually what's there for you in the future. But don't rush after that taste of freedom. It just all happens naturally. Remember the path, the kindness, the generosity, the beauty, the stillness, the letting go. That has been the theme of this meditation retreat, this beautiful power of letting go. And many of you have been to other retreats where they've been working so hard, you've been forcing the mind so much. And I think from my own experience and from the experience of all those other meditators, you find the path of letting go, when you understand what it truly is and put it into practice, it's so much more powerful. You get to deeper states of mind, incredibly powerful, blissful states of mind. So this power of letting go, and it means all the way you have this generosity, this happiness, this peace. So even if you don't go deep, just going a small amount, you get so much back in return. And it's teaching you not just how to meditate in life, but how to go about your business in life. Because soon when you leave here, you'll be back with your families, with your work. I'll be back traveling and giving more talks, and back in my monastery in Perth by tomorrow evening. You'll be back doing things again. But when you're doing things, always remember that taste of freedom. And do things a little bit more gently. Speak a bit more softly. This silent retreat which we've done here, it's not that hard to keep your mouth closed. Because when your mouth is closed, your ears are open. When your mouth is open, your ears are closed. So always remember that. If someone's talking to you, you have to open your ears by closing your mouth. If you can do that, you know how to listen. And there's so much to listen to in life. We all want to be teachers and help other people, but very few of us want to be learners and listen to others. More importantly, there's too few people really want to listen to life, want to listen to their heart, want to listen to their body, want to listen to the beauty of life. And when you meditate more and more in this silence, you become much greater listeners. And when you become a great listener, it works on so many wonderful levels in your daily life. Not only with your relationships, with your husband, with your wife, with your children, with your parents. You can listen to the people you live with. Total listening. And it's wonderful what you'll hear. You'll hear much more than the words they're saying. You'll hear also what's between the words, what's around the words. In their words you will hear the pain or the joy of their emotions. It's very easy for people to cover up what they really feel. But when you totally listen, you will hear their cries, their joys, their pleas, their wants. You will truly be able to communicate with the people you're with. Total listening means the person who's with you, as I said in the book, is the most important person in the world, and you care enough to listen to them. And I mention that it's such an obvious teaching, but how many of you in your family life sometimes feel you're not heard? Feel the other person, you're trying to say something to them, is just closed, and They're just thinking in old ways, they're not really hearing what you're saying. If you felt that, be sure that other people have felt the same about you. Sometimes they've been talking and you haven't been truly listening. And in the worldly life, you have those relationships. It's so important to be able to listen to your friends. Maybe that's one reason I have a harmonious monastery. Even though I'm an abbot of that monastery, I take time to totally listen to all those monks who are under my care. Not even to the monks, but the people who are training to be monks, as visitors as well. To totally listen to them and feel their concerns and act appropriately. So the silence which you developed on this retreat will help you totally listen. And you'll find your relationships, your family life, will be enhanced with more understanding, harmony and happiness. It's horrible when we have arguments amongst our family, when the children disobey their parents or the parents get angry at their children, the husbands and wives scream at each other. It's not necessary at all. It's all because our lack of understanding, our lack of listening, our lack of compassion has gone too far. We're in this terrible situation which causes pain to everybody. So you'll find that this Club Med has also been relationship counselling. You'll find it's much easier to live with the people, you know, you share the same house with. And also you find those of you who are in business, sometimes you think, what's this to do with business? I found out a week or two ago I'd been invited to the next International Conference on Human Resources in Singapore next May. We have all these CEOs of these big companies from the US, from Europe, from around the world. These CEOs and their HR managers, human resources managers, are coming from this international conference in Singapore. They've invited me to be one of the keynote speakers at a business conference. And they asked, what does a monk like Ajahn Brahm know about business? What's he doing? You know, talking to the VPs of, you know, Microsoft and Dell and all these other big companies. And the reason I've been invited there is because this Dhamma, what you've heard here, is good for business. And a few sharp people in Singapore have realized that. So this retreat, it's not just for your spiritual life. You find your profits are going to go up as a result of this. It's a good investment. The reason is because when you come on a retreat like this, this total listening means you can listen and understand your clients. You can adjust your products accordingly. When you sell, sales need trust. And you can give that trust. Because your mind and your heart will be empowered. And if you're in finance, maybe with the peace of your heart, maybe you can intuit what's going to rise and what's going to fall. I knew a man like that. He was a supporter of the monastery in Sitas. He was a great meditator. And he did have some psychic powers. He could actually tell how the stock market was going to be the next day. That's why he made a heap of money. So this is also good for your business. It's just that sensitivity which a lot of people, because they're so insensitive, that they don't feel and they don't adapt accordingly. And of course I've mentioned many times in this retreat just how that stillness, that peace, that lack of striving, that lack of stress opens up channels of energy through your body to heal the sicknesses which each one of us face from time to time. If you follow this method, you'll be going back stronger, fitter, healthier, more energized. And some of those sicknesses which sometimes you would have to go and visit a doctor for and pay huge amounts of money and time to heal are nipped in the bud by lessening the stress. And the stress levels of any doctor knows increases. All these terrible chemicals, the stress chemicals are released into your bloodstream and they wreak havoc on your health. and you really relax. The stress chemicals don't get released into your blood. What I call the metta chemicals get released instead. And these little metta chemicals, they work all through the body. The little bump here, there we go, little catch. You can go away now, thank you. Oh God. Nice little stress here. There you go, stress. You'll be okay. Calm down. These metta chemicals coursing through your body, healing and soothing, and getting rid of all the blockages and the pain and the stuff which is going wrong. Incredibly powerful. So you have all these amazing benefits from this meditation. But perhaps the best benefit of all is expectations. You've learned how just to be in the moment and not anticipate anything. And so I'm going to close this closing talk by asking you, please never expect, never go to the future. Even though you think this retreat is about to end soon, don't go home until your car reaches the gate of your house. You're still on retreat. You're still here. If you haven't read this story in my book, I usually would tell this at the end of every retreat. There was a friend of mine. His name was Ham Wong from New Zealand. And he was ordained. He chose a Korean tradition to be ordained into. And that was one of the tough traditions. And every year they would have a meditation retreat. However, that retreat wasn't just 9 days. It was 60 days. 60 days retreat. And you had a sort of dormitory, but the dormitory was very much a place where you sat meditation. So at night time, just where you were sitting, you put the two cushions out and you'd lay right there, so you couldn't go hiding in your room at all. And you got up at 3 o'clock when the bell went, and 3 o'clock, 5 minutes to go to the toilet, and then for the whole day it was 50 minutes sitting meditation, 10 minutes of walking, 50 minutes of sitting, 10 minutes of walking, 50 minutes of sitting, 10 minutes of walking. The meals were served right where you were. There were no chairs, and it came to about 10 o'clock at night, the bell went, and then you could go and rest. Or if you wanted to, you can carry on meditating. And the only break from the meditation area was to go either to the toilet or to go and visit the master for the interview. And those Korean Zen masters were the exact opposite of Ajahn Vum. They were tough and they were fearsome. So no matter how much it was hurting, it was usually better to sit still rather than go for an interview. And this was a Westerner. He's actually from New Zealand. So you can imagine just how his knees and back felt after 2 or 3 days of sitting for such long periods without any respite at all. After about 1 week, he thought he was going insane with the pain. Every joint ached, it hurt so much. And when it got down to about 9, 10 o'clock at night, he thought, great, now I can rest, have some sleep. But as soon as you lay down, the pain was so great, could hardly sleep. And then when he did go off to sleep, it was just a moment, the bell went, 3 o'clock in the morning, back up sitting again. There was hardly any break at all. And after about 9 or 10 days, he just wanted to run away. It hurt that much. But he looked around him and saw all these Korean monks sitting there. And he was a Westerner. He was proud. He said, I can't be outdone by these Koreans. I'm as good as they are. So he carried on sitting. When it got to 2 weeks, he was aching and hurting so much he thought he would cry. But still he kept pushing in, pushing on. Because he'd endured so much after 2 weeks. To give up now was like being unfaithful to all his effort. So he just carried on pushing, pain day after day, hour after hour. It was excruciating. He'd never experienced so much pain anymore. He was hanging on by a thread. And then came 30 days, the halfway mark. I hope you never thought that way during the sleep. 4 days to go, 3 days to go, 2 days to go. That's what he started doing. When it was halfway, he convinced himself that the worst was over. And so he could carry on a little bit longer. But of course the worst isn't over. The longer you do it, the worse it gets. And sometimes he thought he was going mad with the pain. It hurt so much. But he was a tough man. He kept pushing and struggling. And then when it got to 1 week, it was like he was on the home stretch. He'd done, was it, 53 days, only 7 days to go. Yeah, he could make it, he thought. When he got to the last day, you'd think, only 1 day to go, it's easy. The way he said it was, that last day was the most painful of all. He said it was like pain was holding back until then. But now on the last day, it was a full and brutal assault. He tried to hold the pain back, thinking only a few hours to go. But then pain would come crashing through his defences and completely obsess his mind. He was tortured that last day, and the time went so slowly. When it came to the last 50 minutes, only 50 minutes to go, just 50 minutes, and all this pain will disappear. Because after these retreats, people give them a beautiful dinner. They can have one of these hot Korean baths to ease the aches and pains. And the following morning they could sleep in. Imagine that, sleeping in like you're going to do tomorrow morning. You don't have to get up at 4 o'clock or 5 o'clock. And you can sleep in your lovely bed. There's been nobody snoring next to you. You can eat whatever you want afterwards. Ah, bliss when I get home. Have you planned what you're going to do when you get home this afternoon, this evening? That's what he was doing. And every time he planned a little bit, just again the pain overcame his thoughts. And he opened his eyes to try and steal a look at the clock. He was sure half an hour had gone past. Only 5 minutes. How can that be, he thought. Maybe the batteries of the clock are running out. Perhaps the time, perhaps 30 minutes has gone past, but it's only 5 minutes on the clock. Perhaps, he thought in terror, the batteries might run out altogether and the clock may be stopped. That last 50 minutes, he said, was the longest 50 minutes of his whole life. It took an eon to finish. As he was holding out for the last meditation of the whole 60 days. You can imagine what it was like for him when he heard the final gong. The final gong of the final meditation session. He said at that point all the pain disappeared. And he had this euphoria come up in his body. He'd made it, he'd done it. Something so difficult which at times threatened to break his spirit completely. He'd survived. He'd won. And he was so overjoyed. Bring on the bath. Bring on the food. Yeah. And he was about to bow and leave when the abbot rang the bell again. He said, before you go, I have an announcement to make. During the interviews, many of you monks have told me just how well you've done on this retreat. And what a special time it has been for many of you. In fact, a few of you have made such good progress, you've made the request that we extend this retreat for 2 weeks. Having considered this request, I think it's a very good idea. Carry on sitting, the retreat is extended. So this poor monk had to cross his legs. No bath, no food, more meditation. And he said there was no pain. No pain at all. Because his mind was consumed with anger. Just raw, red, murderous anger. He just wanted to find out who those stupid monks were. The smart asses. And he was, once he found out what they were, he was planning what to do to them. Slowly. How he... And they're very, very unmonkish things to think. He was just irate. He said about 15 minutes went past in a flash when the bell went again. And the abbot said, retreat over, the baths are hot, food is down there, go and enjoy. And this poor monk said, what's going on? Is the retreat finished or is it not finished? Why can't the abbot make up his mind? What's going on? And one of the other monks came up to him and said, look, don't mind about this. The abbot does the same trick every year. And that little monk told me that he learned much more in those 15 minutes about meditation than the whole 60 days. He learned about the pain which is caused from expectation, and the frustration when our expectations don't come to fruition. Sometimes we ask for trouble when we expect what's going to happen next. The truth of the Dhamma is it's uncertain. You don't know what's going to happen next. And in fact, talking with Judy, many of you have such wonderful experience in this meditation retreat, it's now extended for another 7 days, so you can't go home. Unfortunately, that's not true. I'll confess the offense of breaking my precepts afterwards. But you can understand what happens with expectations. So don't expect anything in life. Be in the moment. You may have sort of tentative plans of what might happen next, but don't be so fixed in the way you move through life. Always be able to adapt, and then you'll understand what that monk learned from his retreat. Not to look to the future at all, but to be peaceful, to accept, to let go in the present. And whether that's in meditation or in life, that's the way to nirvana, to success in business, success in your relationships, to good health. It's called the taste of freedom. So may the taste of freedom you've experienced in this retreat turn into full-blown freedom, to give you peace and happiness, and to inspire all the people you meet. This meditation is such a wonderful thing to do, where more and more people will be coming to Club Med, to the point where the Club Med franchise of Ajahn Brahm becomes even more powerful and more successful than the other Club Med, that we do a takeover and we take all Club Med resorts into meditation centers in the future. Wouldn't that be nice? Okay. Go on. Now we have the taking of the 5 precepts. So you are now relieved of your 8 precepts, and we instead will give you the 5 precepts. So just give them that. Okay. Do you want to ask them first of all? I just give them straight away. So I'll say the Namo Tassa first of all. When I finish the Namo Tassa, then you say after me. Namo Tassa Bhagavato Arahato Sammasambuddhassa. Namo Tassa Bhagavato Arahato Sammasambuddhassa. Namo Tassa Bhagavato Arahato Sammasambuddhassa. Buddhaṃ saraṇaṃ gacchāmi. Dhammaṃ saraṇaṃ gacchāmi. Sanghaṃ saraṇaṃ gacchāmi. Dutiyampi buddhaṃ saraṇaṃ gacchāmi. Dutiyampi dhammaṃ saraṇaṃ gacchāmi. Dutiyampi sanghaṃ saraṇaṃ gacchāmi. Tatiyampi buddhaṃ saraṇaṃ gacchāmi. Tatiyampi dhammaṃ saraṇaṃ gacchāmi. Tatiyampi Sanghaṃ Saraṇaṃ Gacchāmi. That completes the three refuges. I will now give the five precepts. Pānāti pātā viramani sikkhāpadaṃ samādhiyāmi. Adina dana viramani sikkhāpadaṃ samādhiyāmi. Kāmesu micchācara viramani sikkhāpadaṃ samādhiyāmi. Musāvādā viramani sikkhāpadaṃ samādhiyāmi. Surah mevayam japamadatana viramani sikkhāpadaṃ samādhiyāmi. Imani pancha sikkhāpadāni sīlena sukhatiṃ yanti sīlena bhogasampadā sīlena nipputiṃ yanti tasmā sīlaṃ visoddhayeṃ.